Well, I must first thank Father LaRue for his kind invitation, which has been a standing invitation. I've been the problem. It may have been a standing invitation, but I've been sitting more and more as I grow older. So, and also, as you grow older, I'll talk about this constantly because I now count myself an old man. Everything you do everything more slowly, and yet more things are demanded of you. So you have no time to do anything. And I have been meaning to come and visit and give some lectures, and it simply didn't happen. I was always preempted or booked elsewhere or too busy or flat on my back, something like that. So finally it worked out because I officially retired on January 2nd. I'm a new retiree, and I've taken to it like a duck to water, something I should have done years ago. In fact, probably before I began working. But I taught for 38 years, 28 of them at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And it was a great honor. It has been a great gift to be a teacher. I intend to keep doing it, though not as frequently, and I don't have to give grades anymore. People said to me, "Are you going to have a retirement party?" I said, "No, I'm not." But the day I graded my last freshman essay, I partied all night long. No more sentence fragments, comma splices, misspelled words. I graded millions of those things over my years of teaching, and I don't have to do it anymore. So I'm happy to come and talk. You will not be tested. You have no papers you need to turn in. It has been, I think, 6 years since I was last here. It's been a while, so I see an entirely new crop of faces. I am astonished at your number, astonished and gratified. And one thing you must do for me, since I'm an old bachelor school teacher, seminarians come from good families. So your first obligation is to give thanks to your parents for the good upbringing you had, which is one reason you are here. And I am very hopeful that as the traditional faith continues to grow and more traditional homes are founded, that there will be a greater number of vocations coming to the society. It's a great good. So congratulate your parents on my behalf. Number of changes since I was last here. Most shocking one is that I'm standing where the bowling alley used to be. If I suddenly look puzzled in the midst of this talk, it's because I'll expect someone in the back to stand up and roll a ball down the aisle and knock me over like a standing tin pin. So, it shows that the number of seminarians has increased. Certainly, the size of the rooms to teach in have expanded, and the coffee cups have expanded. The coffee cups are now enormous. They used to be just dinky little cups. So I assume they're doing this to help keep you awake and keep the caffeine in your system so you can get through your busy days. So expansion everywhere, including my waistline. It's what happens as time goes on. It's very curious, so let me give a little excuse here at first, to come in the midst of Lent in order to talk about what is probably the greatest comic novel ever written. Lent is a very serious season. I considered doing something serious. But the reason I've chosen Quixote is threefold. Number one, it's a very important Catholic work, and I'll get to that later. I'll just mention it first. It is one of the great works in Western art. It's certainly, I think, the greatest and best-known work in Spanish literature. It has some very special meaning, I think, for Catholics, and especially for battling Catholics. So, but I will come to that later, okay? Second reason is that I've not lectured on it here before, so this is new material for you, although it's very funny. After Mass last Sunday, a very lovely lady that I was having coffee with said, you're going to the seminary. I said, yes, I'm going to be talking. She said, oh, what are you talking on? She said, Don Quixote. And she said, well, that's very odd. Haven't you spoken on that before? I said, well, yes, I have in various places, and I will keep speaking on it as long as I can. And that brings me to reason number three. I love this book. I love this book. Undoubtedly, I will speak, God willing, I will speak on it again in the future. There's a wonderful moment at the beginning of part two of the Quixote, where the bachelor, Samson Carrasco, who's graduated from the university and becomes sort of a nemesis of Quixote in part two, is talking about people reading the first part. I'll explain this in a bit. Part two was published 10 years later, so part one was well known when part two came out. And this intellectual, he's the young intellectual, refers to the book and says, children finger it, young people read it, grown men quote it by heart, and old men praise it. Well, I'm an old man now, and I'm here to praise this book, which I love dearly. I maybe have three favorite, the desert island joke, okay? What would you take with you? Well, of course, you get to take the Bible and Shakespeare. Those two are a given. When asked what else I would certainly take Dante. I'd want my copy of the Divine Comedy. I would take Evelyn Waugh's Bride's Head Revisited, which I've lectured on here. I have a whole, there's a whole series on that. And I'd have to take Don Quixote, which I absolutely adore. So I'm speaking on it for that reason. But there's another reason, and let me just describe it this way. Near the end of part one of the Quixote, at the inn, Quixote encounters a canon who's traveling through, and they get into a little debate. And someone's explaining to the canon that this poor old man is not quite right in the head, and that he's been driven mad by reading books of knight-errantry. And the canon says, well, they're not that bad, and says the following, that it's probably not good for those old books to be eclipsed in the bright presence of the new. Those old books provide honest amusement, not only for the idle, but for the busiest of men. For it is impossible for the brow to be always bent, nor can our frail human nature sustain itself without some lawful recreation. So just as we know there is a Sunday in Lent that is cheerful, I will take this moment on the eve, we'll call it, of the Feast of St. Joseph, so we can unbend our brows a bit and have some honest recreation, which the book certainly is. So, thus my excuse for talking about Quixote in the midst of Lent. But before I get to the book, there's some background material I have to give you. And this may seem quite unusual to you, although I'll make a connection to it very soon. I want to start out by reading you a longish poem. Some of you may know this. I hope you do. By the great English writer and poet G.K. Chesterton. It's called Lepanto. And it is a poem that talks about that great sea battle that took place in 1571 off the coast of western Greece, where the Turks were making their move to try to enter into Europe. Historians, by common consent, agree that the stand that was taken there by Christian Europe kept Europe Christian. The force of the Muslims, and needless to say, it's an ongoing battle, it's ranged over centuries and continues. The Turks were ready to assault Europe, hope to take over Europe. Don John of Austria became the commander of the forces of Europe, and the great sea battle was fought at Lepanto. It was a five-hour battle that determined the fate of Europe for many, many centuries to come. Now, Cervantes fought in that battle. He was on one of those ships. I'll talk about that at length in a moment. But this is a poem written by Chesterton about the event. It's a very great historical narrative poem. We shift our focus on a number of occasions here, but there are three major figures that appear. First is the Sultan, the head of the Turkish nations, and the poem opens with him walking in his gardens, knowing that his forces are about to attack and perhaps make their way into Europe. Secondly, we meet the old Pope who is in Rome. And of course, it is Pope St. Pius V, who had been one of the motivating forces for the troops to gather together and put up opposition to the coming Turks. He knew very well what it meant, as well as the fact, it's a wonderful, wonderful story, that when the Christian forces of Don John defeated the Turks, the saintly Pope was given a vision that it had happened and said to everyone who was there in Rome with him, on their knees to give thanks to God, for the forces of Christ had been triumphant. And it was indeed accurate. It was right at the time they had triumphed. So the old Pope is in the poem. And of course, Don John of Austria is there all the way through the poem, who is leading the forces. You'll see why I'm reading this. Bear with me. G.K. Chesterton, Lepanto. White fonts falling in the courts of the sun, and the Sultan of Byzantium is smiling as they run. There is laughter like the fountains in that face of all men feared. It stirs the forest darkness, the darkness of his beard. It curls the blood-red crescent, the crescent of his lips. For the inmost sea of all the earth is shaken with his ships. They have dared the white republics up the capes of Italy. They have dashed the Adriatic round the lion of the sea. And the Pope has cast his arms abroad for agony and loss and called the kings of Christendom for swords about the cross. The cold Queen of England is looking in the glass. The shadow of the Valois is yawning at the mass. From Evening Isle's fantastical rings faint the Spanish gun, and the Lord upon the golden horn is laughing in the sun. Dim drums throbbing in the hills half heard, where only on a nameless throne a crownless prince has stirred, where risen from a doubtful seat in half a tainted stall, the last knight of Europe takes weapons from the wall. The last and lingering troubadour to whom the bird has sung that once went singing southward when all the world was young. In that enormous silence, tiny and unafraid, comes up along a winding road the noise of the crusade. Strong gongs groaning as the guns boom far. Don John of Austria is going to the war. Stiff flags straining in the night blasts cold, in the gloom black purple, in the glint old gold. Torchlight crimson on the copper kettle drums, then the tuckets, then the trumpets, then the cannon, and he comes. Don John laughing in the brave beard curled, spurning of his stirrups like the thrones of all the world, holding his head up for a flag of all the free. Love light of Spain, hurrah, death light of Africa, Don John of Austria is riding to the sea. Mahood is in his paradise above the evening star. Don John of Austria is going to the war. He moves a mighty turban on the timeless Houri's knees, his turban that is woven of the sunsets and the seas. He shakes the peacock gardens as he rises from his ease, and he strides among the treetops and is taller than the trees. And his voice through all the garden is a thunder sent to bring Black Azrael and Ariel and Amon on the wing, giants and the genii, multiplex of wing and eye, whose strong obedience broke the sky when Solomon was king. They rush in red and purple from the red clouds of the morn, from the temples where the yellow gods shut up their eyes in scorn. They rise in green robes roaring from the green hells of the sea, where fallen skies and evil hues and eyeless creatures be. On them the sea bells cluster, and the gray sea forests curl, splashed with a splendid sickness, the sickness of the pearl. They swell in sapphire smoke out of the blue cracks of the ground. They gather and they wonder and they give worship to Mahound. And he saith, break up the mountains where the hermit folk can hide, and sift the red and silver sands lest bone of saint abide, and chase the gyres flying night and day, not giving rest, for that which was our trouble comes again out of the west. We have set the seal of Solomon on all things under sun, of knowledge and of sorrow and endurance of things done. But a noise is in the mountains, and I know the voice that shook our palaces 400 years ago. It is he that saith not kismet. It is he that knows not fate. It is Richard. It is Raymond. It is Godfrey at the gate. It is he whose loss is laughter when he counts the wager worth. Put down your feet upon him, that our peace be on the earth. For he heard drums groaning, and he heard guns jar. Don John of Austria is going to the war. Sudden and still hurrah! Bolt from Iberia, Don John of Austria is gone by Alcalar. St. Michael's on his mountain in the sea roads of the north. Don John of Austria is girt and going forth, where the gray seas glitter and the sharp tides shift, and the sea folk labor and the red sails lift. He shakes his lance of iron and he claps his wings of stone. The noise is gone through Normandy. The noise is going alone. The north is full of tangled things and texts and aching eyes, and dead is all the innocence of anger and surprise. And Christian killeth Christian in a narrow, dusty room, and Christian dreadeth Christ that hath a newer face of doom, and Christian hateth Mary that God kissed in Galilee, but Don John of Austria is riding to the sea. Don John calling through the blast and the eclipse, crying with the trumpet of his lips. Trumpet that saith, ha, Domino Gloria, Don John of Austria is shouting to the ships. King Philip's in his closet with the fleece about his neck. Don John of Austria is armed upon the deck. The walls are hung with velvet that is black and soft as sin, and little dwarfs creep out of it, and little dwarfs creep in. He holds a crystal phial that has colors like the moon. He touches, and it tingles, and it trembles very soon, and his face is as a fungus of a leprous white and gray, like plants in the high houses that are shuttered from the day, and death is in the phial, and the end of noble work. But Don John of Austria has fired upon the Turk. Don John's hunting, and his hounds have bayed. Booms away past Italy the rumor of his raid. Gun upon gun, ha-ha! Gun upon gun, hurrah! Don John of Austria has loosed the cannonade. The Pope was in his chapel before day or battle broke. Don John of Austria is hidden in the smoke. The hidden room in man's house where God sits all the year. The secret window whence the world looks small and very dear. He sees as in a mirror on the monstrous twilight sea the crescent of his cruel ships whose name is mystery. They fling great shadows forwards, making cross and castle dark. They veil the plumed lions on the galleys of St. Mark. And above the ships are palaces of brown black-bearded chiefs, and below the ships are prisons, where with multitudinous griefs Christian captives sick and sweat. They are lost like slaves that sweat, and in the skies of morning hung the stairways of the tallest gods when tyranny was young. They are countless, voiceless, hopeless, as those fallen or fleeing on before the high king's horses in the granite of Babylon. And many a one grows witless in his quiet room in hell, where a yellow face looks inward through the lattice of his cell, and he finds his God forgotten, and he seeks no more a sign. But Don John of Austria has burst the battle line, Don John pounding from the slaughter-painted poop, purpling all the ocean like a bloody pirate sloop, scarlet running over on the silvers and the golds, breaking of the hatches up, and bursting of the holds, thronging of the thousands up the labor under sea, white for bliss and blind for sun, and stung for liberty. Vivat Hispania, Domino Gloria, Don John of Austria has set his people free. Cervantes, on his galley, sets the sword back in the sheath. Don John of Austria rides homeward with a wreath, and he sees upon a weary land a straggling road in Spain, up which a lean and foolish knight forever rides in vain. And he smiles, but not as sultans smile, and settles back the blade. But Don John of Austria rides home from the crusade. Notice what Chesterton does, however. He takes this enormous conflict that involved much of the world at that time, a mini world war, if you will. He presents it as a narrative, almost a ballad poem, those wonderful rhythms that just keep pulling you through the poem. It's a masterful piece of poetry. But when we come to the end, past the Sultan and King Philip II and Don John and even Pope St. Pius V, he ends the poem with one soldier who indeed was below ships that day and very sick with a fever and told he could not fight. This is part of a pattern of Cervantes' life that I will talk about. Constant failure. Endless failure. His big moment, the big battle, he's sick and he's ordered to stay below ships. He couldn't stand it. He rises up and finally gets permission in the thick of the battle to join the fray, where he's wounded in the chest and loses the use of his left hand forever. The left hand crippled from that day forward. But out of it, Chesterton shows him getting a glimpse of a lonely knight riding a barren road through Spain, always failing but never defeated. And with his healthy hand, he writes the book. He writes the book. If you want an image that I think is an image of Christ's church throughout the centuries, you couldn't find anything better than the foolishness of giving up all for one man who died on the cross. That's why the world thinks we're all crazy. And that we persist in it when the world has long ago, the world thinks, outgrown all of that. And second of all, to see it constantly go down in seeming failure, to be overcome by hostile forces, to see its territories diminish, to see the faith challenged, to see heresies rise up, to see all sorts of splintering take place. And yet, what do we know? Seemingly always losing, but eternally winning. And the fact of the matter is, for all of the seeming foolishness and defeats as the world sees it, those who have the faith know very well we have a promise that that church will endure until the end of time. Why? Because it will always, through God's grace, pick itself up and keep going forward. And what could be more foolish than those who keep picking up and going forward with it, giving up what the world has to offer? Your seminarians, you've already made certain sacrifices. You've already decided to give up certain things that the world has to offer, and the world thinks nothing could be more foolish. Why do you do it? Out of a commitment to a higher ideal, a higher truth, and even though you may make mistakes and bumble along the way and fall occasionally, there is no greater battle to fight. All of this is somehow contained in comic mode, in gentle mode, in uplifting mode, in this miraculous and wonderful book. Chesterton obviously didn't think that Lepanto was fought so that Quixote could be written. But the fact of the matter is that out of Lepanto and the victory of that great battle came this figure. What can we say about it? He escaped the book that contained him. You talk to people who have never picked up the book, know nothing about it, and they're going to know who Don Quixote is. By the way, I should say Don Quixote, which is the English way of saying it, or the French way, Don Quixote. But I've always said Don Quixote. I'm addicted to it. You'll have to put up with me. When I was taught the book, that's the way I learned it. So that's what I have to call. He's Quixote to me. But the point is, he's escaped the book. He's become mythic. I got a cartoon yesterday that was sent to me on email from a former student. Those great new wind turbines they're putting up to provide wind energy that have about 3 or 4 prongs, just enormous things. You see them on the country. They're imposing. They're frightening. And there are these two little figures looking at them, and one says to the other, "Say, I'm terrified of those things. Look at how big those are. Those things are very frightening." And all of a sudden, they uproot themselves, and they begin spinning, and they start marching on these two little people who are standing there. And one of them screams, "Al Gore, what have you done to us?" And they both begin running. And as they're running and these great wind turbines are coming after them, the one shouts to the other, "Who will save us?" And the final panel, not a word in it, this little thin knight on an old horse with his lance. Well, everybody who sees the cartoon knows who it is. They've not read the book. He is a mythic figure. And part of the glory of it and part of the greatness of the comic creation of Quixote is he will not be defeated. He may be nuts sometimes. We'll have to talk about this. He may be nuts most of the time. But there is in him a core of idealism and virtue, and he is trying to fight for the good and the true according to his vision of the beauty of his lady that he's fighting for. I'll have much to say about her later. It's a glorious vision. It's completely cockeyed and crazy. And he can't see properly. What is it that appeals to everyone about this figure? It has to do with the fact we all possess ideals. We all hope to do our best. The fact of the matter is, we keep botching things up. And just at the moment of many of what we hope will be our greatest triumphs, bam! The beauty of Quixote is he picks himself up, brushes himself off, spits out the teeth he's lost, and goes home. It's simply extraordinary. It has to do with the persistence of the vision in the face of what you bring on yourself and what the world does to you. And you keep on going. It is so deeply rooted in us, and there is something so powerful and good in it that the whole world knows this figure. If he began as a comic invention, a joke attacking the foolishness of these books of knight-errantry, he ends up being a model of something positive, though foolish, that has gripped the world for centuries. As one critic says, the Russian author Vladimir Nabokov, The parody has become a paragon. This foolish figure that was drawn to be laughed at suddenly is everybody's vision of a knight. How did this happen? The world, in a way, has taken him and turned him into what he madly thought he was. Well, that's part of what we're going to look at in these lectures. Because I don't think it's accidental. I think there are very good reasons for it. There are very few characters out of modern literature, and by that I mean the last 500 years, that have become mythic. The Greeks could do myths. Everybody, you know, Achilles, Odysseus, the Cyclops. I mean, these figures are enormous. The Greeks just produce myths one after another. Modern literature, well, it's not been good at doing much of anything. But it's given us a few. Everybody knows who Romeo and Juliet are. If you're going to talk about young lovers and make fun of them, you call them a Romeo and Juliet, even if you've never seen or read the play. They've come to stand for something quite apart from the work. An old, mean-spirited miser is a Scrooge. Dickens gave us one. Everybody knows who Scrooge is. And everybody knows who this foolish, mad old knight is. Don Quixote. He's escaped the work that created him. He's become part of the larger world of just general knowledge. Not just Cervantes doing. Other artists have been fascinated by him. I can't begin to go through all of the visual artists who have painted him and done drawings and cartoons of him. It's endless. But in other spheres as well. In music, the opera Don Quixote by Massenet, the songs of Don Quixote by Ravel, the great opera, short opera, 25 minutes, Master Peter's Puppet Show, based on one episode from Quixote, by Manuel de Falla, the great Richard Strauss tone poem called Don Quixote, where Quixote is represented by the cello and has these adventures, and Strauss creates in the orchestra the adventure with the sheep, for example. He's got the whole... the brass section using their mutes and braying like sheep. It's an unbelievable sound invention that's glorious. As Quixote goes riding into the middle of them, slaying them. I'll talk about that. That wonderful scene right and left. It's just well, he's crazy. What can you say? He's crazy. Over and over again, others have been inspired by him. Many attempts to do Don Quixote movies, they have failed. There seems to be some... he will not let himself be put on the screen. Catastrophic film done by one of the Monty Python men who... Terry Gilliam wanted to do a film of Quixote. A documentary filmmaker went to just film the making of the film. He couldn't get the film made. The catastrophes that befall are unbelievable. The film was never made, but the documentary called Lost in La Mancha is just heartrending. It shows you what making a movie is like and how you... the one catastrophe after another, where you can't believe it. Orson Welles tried for 25 years to make a film of Quixote. Could never do it. We have little snippets of film. From the snippets, you can tell it would have been... Quixote will not let himself be transferred to the screen, it seems. It doesn't happen. This figure has inspired many other artists. But he arrives to us first in this massive book. It's a big book. I've got to say a word or two about translation, and let me do it right here before I proceed. I have been told the original... I got an American education. I'm a nitwit, okay? Especially in the field of languages. I know a little bit of French, enough to get my poor French sister-in-law upset when I try to speak it with her. As my French teacher told me when I was first studying it, I was the only person she ever heard who spoke French with a heavy Norwegian accent. Little French, touches of German, Italian that I picked up from opera librettos, a little bit of Russian, snatches of Russian, bits of Latin thanks to the Mass, virtually no Greek. I know nothing. Okay, But I am told by those who speak and read Spanish that the original is difficult but quite remarkable. But I've not read the original. But I will tell you this. The English translations are terrible. Now, we're lucky it's a prose work because prose can be translated. You can't translate poetry. The great American poet Robert Frost said, in defining poetry, poetry is that which gets lost in translation. The minute you translate it, it's gone. And there's a reason for that, in that poetry is both sense and sound, and they're interlinked. Poetry is verbal music. So if you change the sounds, you know, it's like saying, I'll play for you a Beethoven piano sonata, but I'm going to change all the notes. Oh, that'll be good. How I look forward to hearing it. Okay. Poetry is sound and sense linked together. You change the sounds, you don't have poetry. Prose is not like that, so you can translate prose. The problem with almost all the English prose translations is that nobody can write anymore. They are bumbling, they are hard to read, the sentences are convoluted, they are either so slavish to the original or so ill-equipped to translate, they're terrible. And the second problem is it's done by scholars at universities. I spent my life in them. I know what they're like. They have no sense of humor at all. None. You don't want humorless people translating comic novels. You end up with humorless novels, okay? The problem with most Quixote translations is they're not funny. The translators can't do the jokes. Now, here's the problem, and I see some of you, God bless you, have the new Penguin translation. This is sad, but there's an easy remedy and a good remedy. For 50 years, the old Penguin translation, a gentleman named J.M. Cohen, I don't know who he was, that was the Penguin translation. That's what you want. It's the one translation in English that is not only readable, but funny. So if you have the new one, give it as a gift to someone you don't like, that you know won't read it. And the old one you can find for absolute cheap. It's in used bookstores. It's everywhere. It was the old Penguin translation for 50 years. Old Penguin translation. You can find it. It's everywhere, okay? And it's cheap, 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 cheap. The others, you can fight your way through, but better to pay the $4 and find the old Penguin and enjoy it, okay? Barnes & Noble put this out briefly. It's the Cohen translation with lovely illustrations, a few critical essays, a couple of which actually are worth reading. Very unusual when scholars comment on literature. But this is hard to find. If you find it, it's worth a little more money. In any case, J.M. Cohen, Old Penguin Classics. It came out in about 1950, lasted into the 2000s, and then they put out a new one. I won't take the time to do comparison shopping, but trust me on this one. You, for a few bucks, get the old one. And we'll see some examples of it along the way. Translation is tough in the best of circumstances. Cohen is readable and has a sense of humor. He delivers the jokes. Jokes are all about rhythm and timing, and boy, can he do it. His translation is funny. You will laugh. The others, you read the whole book and not break a smile. Say, what? He said this was a funny book. I don't know. This isn't funny. Okay. Now, a few words about the thing itself. I promise I'm going to get to the book. The other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to try to leave some time at the end of each of these sessions for questions. So if you've got questions, write them down. I'll be happy to take them, just so you remember them. Although you're young, you remember. I remember nothing. Memory is shot. This is a very strange book in another way. What Cervantes did was create a new literary genre. And this is very strange. There had been long prose works before, but they fell into the category of the books that Cervantes is mocking. Old romances that were overblown. I'll talk about them at length. Knight-errantry, enchanters, giants, dragons. Okay, they were, let us just put it this way, they were not of this world. They were not connected with this world in any way. When Cervantes published this book, he did something very new. And most people call the publication of Don Quixote the birth of the modern novel. Most people call Don Quixote the first novel. Many of us think it was the first and remains the best and the greatest. And other of the great novelists who might qualify for that would agree that Quixote's probably the first and the best. Little boy, whose family moved constantly, goes up into the attic of a house they're renting and finds some old books up in the attic. Finds a copy of Don Quixote, sits down, reads it over and over and over and over and over again. Little kid's name, Charles Dickens. A Russian gentleman named Fyodor Dostoevsky, who called Quixote the greatest, funniest, saddest, and most beautiful book in the world. I mean, when you had the other great novelists praising this as the book, then you got to trust them. They know something about Ray. The man who wrote David Copperfield, the man who wrote The Brothers Karamazov and Crime and Punishment, they know something about novel writing. So when they praise this, that's high praise indeed. What came before? Well, this is very curious, and I'll try to explain it because it connects with what's going on in the book. If we go back to the earliest literary forms, what do we have? Well, we've got short fiction, which appeared in a number of ways. Myths. The Greeks created countless myths, and they were handed down. We have fables, usually little tiny animal stories, the master of it, of course, being Aesop, that have a little moral lesson at the end. We know our Lord himself, when he walked the earth, didn't lecture and tell people always directly what they needed to know. He spoke in parables. Parables are little short fictions. They're little short stories. I've said repeatedly, I mean this, one way we know God intended for there to be art and storytelling is that in the second person of the Holy Trinity, when God himself became human, he taught through stories. He told stories. Of course that's ingrained in us then. Of course we're meant to listen to stories. And we learn by them. They teach us. They uplift us. Okay? So the fable, the myth, the parable, they were there long ago. The epic poem. Homer, we're talking maybe 800 BC. It's hard to date exactly. The Iliad and the Odyssey being handed down by an oral tradition. It's hard to imagine, but it's true. Those old bards from ancient Greece learned that and recited it aloud. And that's how it got handed out. We're talking old lyric poems. The Homeric hymns, they're called. Hymns to the Greek gods. Very old. 800 to 1000 BC. The Psalms of David. Sacred texts, sacred works, but still beautiful lyric poems. And think how far back they go. The first complete drama we have that is still enacted is Aeschylus's Oresteia from 456 BC. It's old stuff. Old stuff. Meaning all of these forms, short fiction, poetry, drama, go way back. First novel, 1605. Wait a minute. What's going on here? How did we get a new genre? Long narrative fiction. This is new. This is very new. There were reasons for it. Cervantes caught on to something. Number one, times were changing. You could not have the novel, and that's a book that you can pick up open and read, if you didn't have the printing press, all of the older forms were carried on through oral tradition, even the long epic poems. Certainly the telling of myths and fables and parables were told. Drama was acted on a stage. You didn't buy a copy and take home and read. You went and saw it, okay? Those were all oral traditions. All of a sudden, we had a machine that printed books. The printing press arrived, which is going to connect us with the reason why this is one of the great Counter-Reformation works. I'll get to it in a moment, but keep that in mind, okay? The coming of the printing press made a huge change in human history. You could now have books. Books. What else did people have because of the coming of machines? They had some leisure time. Those days when everybody had to work from dawn till dusk just to get food and stay alive, life had become easier. Life had become a good bit easier. And as a result, there was some leisure time. And what did people want to do with the leisure time? One thing they did, since they were now more capable of doing it, was read. Okay? And therefore, they wanted some books, and they could afford books because there was some extra money around. Times were one thing that happened as I grew older as a teacher, I constantly went off on tangents to the point where I'd barely stick to the subject at hand at all. Just endless. At least I announced them now. Here's a tangent. We'll get back to it. Remember where we were, okay? Extra money because the machines are doing some of the work. This has gone on for centuries now. We're at the end of it. You need to be aware of this. This is the world you're going out into. With the coming of the Industrial Revolution, the coming of the machine age, people had free time, worked less, had more money, began to enjoy themselves. That has gone on and increased for centuries to the point where now we have machines that will do everything for us. Okay? I was reading recently about a man who was bemoaning the fact, I'm not making this up, a man bemoaning the fact that it was becoming so expensive to replace his electric toothbrush because they now seal the batteries and you can't just get a new battery to put in it. So instead of having to go like this, you just stick the toothbrush in your mouth and the brush moves on its own. You can't get much lazier than that. Although I say this as a man who only in the last 2 or 3 years has had a dishwasher, so I'm a total fraud. I love the dishwasher. After years of piling up dirty dishes and finally having to do them, now you just stick them in the machine, you turn them, suddenly they're clean dishes. It's magic. Well, it is magic, and it's not necessarily good. And the first point of I'm saying this comically, but I want you to go back and remember something. Why do we have to work? It's punishment for the fall. Remember one of the burdens put on Adam after the fall. You will earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. And they may have before the fall in the garden done things, they certainly did, but I suspect it wasn't work the way we know work, like having to shovel the sidewalk. Or build a barn, or grade a freshman essay, okay? It's work. And as a result, when you finish work, it's like, oh, man, that was hard. Oh, I'm miserable. Adam's fall. It's part of original sin. So one reason I did those for 38 years, although I complained about it, one reason I did it, is it something I owed to God because of Adam's fall, which I participate in? Machine comes. The machine comes. We don't have to work as hard. We don't have to work as much. In fact, you may not have to work at all, and it is not accidental that belief in original sin vanished as the machine age prospered. I don't have to work. That must mean I'm not that bad. Okay? Nor is it an accident that as the machines did more and more and more, somehow I had more money. something wrong here. I'm working less and I'm making more money. We should have been suspicious of this one decades ago. Something real. In the old days, you worked, and maybe you didn't get money, but you got a couple of potatoes and you could feed the wife and the kids, and, you know, at least you could eat. Might not have been a lot of extra cash lying around, but you could eat. Now, I go to the office, I push papers, I come home, big paycheck, buy a third car, buy a big screen plasma TV, okay? Vacations, endless vacations, flying to Acapulco for the weekend because I've got extra cash. Something wrong here. Well, what we're finding out is it wasn't real money. It was phony baloney money. And when you hear that in the last 6 months, something like $3 to $4 trillion has vanished from the world economy, no, it hasn't. It was just sort of like paper being, it was leaves in autumn, but except the leaves are real, connected to nature. That money wasn't real. This whole gig is up. And you'll notice what's happening. People are now desperate for what? Jobs. All of a sudden, as the phony money vanishes, people want some real work. Because forget the third car or the weekend in Acapulco. They need to put potatoes on plates in the house. We're going back to it. It's not necessarily a bad thing, okay? Not necessarily a bad thing. Keep that in mind. Machines make work very easy. Well, we have to work. It's connected with original sin, part of God's plan. Machines say, I don't have to work. Careful. Machines mean I get lots of money. Watch it. It's paper. Don't fall. Well, the whole world fell for it. We're now paying for it. Keep it in mind. Well, books were being published. People had a little easier life. They had some leisure time. They had some money. They wanted to buy books. What did they want to read about themselves? They wanted to read about themselves. And what Cervantes realized, the world he created was not a fantastic world of dragons and knights in castles. No, this is all real. Now, Quixote has a false world in his head from those books of knights and castles and damsels in distress and giants. But in fact, it's an inn and a courtesan and just an innkeeper and a windmill. These are all real things in a real world. And when Quixote and Sancho set out on that road in Spain, they're riding a real dusty road on real horses and going to a real inn where they're going to eat onions and garlic and a little boiled beef. It's a real world. What the novel does better than any other form is to put down the reality of lived life. The great myths, the great epic poems, the great dramas, heroic warriors, great kings, princes, a crazy eccentric gentleman from La Mancha, and his neighbor who's a farmer, riding on dusty roads. It's a different world. It's a recognizable world. It's a real world. For that reason, the novel can be of great interest historically. You want to know what Puritan New England was like, you read The Scarlet Letter. You want to know what life on a whaling vessel in 19th century was like, you read Moby Dick. You want to know what the Napoleonic Wars were like, you read War and Peace. You want to know what went on in England in Victoria's time, you read David Copperfield. You want to find out the truth of those slave labor camps in the Soviet Union, you read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. That's what got him in trouble. It was a novel that started spilling the beans on what had gone on. Why? Because it's a real world. He lived in it. It was tactile. It wasn't made up. And he presented it to the world in a short novel, and it was real. It was real, and everyone was shocked. Okay? The novel can do that. Cervantes started it. Okay? Remarkable. Remarkable thing. Very bright guy. But now's the time. Let me give you his life. it's of some interest. Born in Spain, 1547. And he's the son of, and I love this, this is how it's described in all the biographies. His father was a barber surgeon. Now, this was very common at the time. Your barber wouldn't only cut your hair for you. He'd take care of other problems as well. Which, now, surgeon, not in the same way that we think of it, but if you were not feeling well, you know, your barber would cut your hair and then would be willing to bleed you, which was a common cure for ailments. You know, we'll get some of that bad blood out of you. So, you know. And also worked as a dentist. The thought of my barber pulling my teeth or of my dentist cutting my hair is just, well, one would get the bad end of the bargain. There's not much there to cut. But nevertheless, all of this was rolled into one. Barber, surgeon, dentist. He apparently wasn't real good. Because the family kept moving. If you're very successful in your trade, you don't have to move around a lot. You establish a reputation, people come to you, they're happy to get your services, and you settle down in a community. They work constantly. So we don't know this for certain, but it suggests to me that, oh, you want a haircut? I'm sorry, I bled you. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you didn't want all your teeth pulled. I mean, it may be part of the reason for Cervantes' obsession with losing teeth throughout this book. I mean, the teeth, Quixote must keep regrowing them. I don't know that. Here's a study if any of you wants to be a serious academic. Go through and tally up how many teeth Quixote actually loses during the course of the book. Every battle is spitting teeth and losing more of them. Although Sancho says at one point, that's why he's so gaunt. Because there are no teeth left in his mouth. Apparently not very good. Which means his father, this is my opinion, okay, this is not fact. This is my guessing. Which means his father probably was a failure. Not real good at his profession. But what Cervantes was somehow, we can look back and say, thank heavens. Because what it meant is this boy grew up on the roads of Spain, traveling all over, city to city to city to city to city, and much of the time on the road as they went, which is what his greatest work is going to be about, being on the roads in Spain. And I have no doubt that's how he lived his early years and absorbed it all. Bright kid. So he absorbed it all. He took it all in. And as they went about the roads, something was already germinating, which means out of his father's probable failure comes a great good. What could we call it? Maybe a providential design. Where others might have just seen failure, been annoyed at this man who botched their dental work, the world looks back and says, well, the son did something remarkable. The son did something remarkable. Okay, so very, very lucky there. Devout Catholic family, how do we know this? A couple of ways. When Cervantes is 19, his sister Luisa, with her father's permission, enters St. Teresa's Order of Discalced Carmelites. She entered St. Teresa's Order in 1565 and three times became prioress of the convent on three different occasions, meaning she must have been a very holy woman and a remarkable woman. That doesn't come out of nowhere. That comes out of families again, okay? And God's grace, certainly. But it's easier for God to give his grace to solid, believing families, okay? So we know that. We also know at one point, Cervantes himself, 1609, this is after part one has been published, joined the Confraternity of Slaves of the Blessed Sacrament. And in the month he died, he joined the Third Order of St. Francis. And in fact was buried in his coarse Franciscan habit. Okay? So we've got Catholics here. We've got real Catholics here. very important in understanding what's going on in the book. Now, as a young man, he got himself into trouble. Young men often do this. We know that when he was about 22 years old, he fought a duel. The other man was wounded, not killed, but Cervantes had to flee Spain. He got in so much trouble. He left and went to Rome. So right at the beginning of his life, he has to leave his native land. He goes to Rome. He is taken up in the entourage of a Monsignor Acquaviva, of a high personage in Rome at that time. And it looks as if he may indeed make a good career as part of that world when the order comes. This is 1969-70 that he goes to Rome. When the order comes that Spain is going to help in the battle against the Turks, and Cervantes goes back and enlists in the Spanish military, along with his brother. They were both in it. So that when Don John calls forth the forces of Europe, Cervantes is there. As I said, he sails with those forces. He is there at Lepanto. He's sick that day of a fever. Nevertheless, he rises up finally, gets permission. He goes and fights, chest wound, loses the use of his left hand. Great victory, however. And everybody in Europe knew it was a great victory. And those who went immediately home to whichever country were given great rewards, great honors. But Cervantes was asked to stay on, which means he must have been very good at what he did in the military service. So he stayed on, and for the next 5 years was still in the Spanish fleet patrolling that area. Okay, he's still there. Until 1575, 1576, I'm not sure which date, right around then, he is given letters of recommendation from Don John of Austria himself for his good service, heads back to Spain and doesn't get further than the Barbary coast, and they're attacked by pirates. And the pirates find letters of recommendation on this man from Don John of Austria and figure he's a prize, and he's held captive for 5 years. He is a slave in northern Africa for 5 years. During that time, he attempts at least four or five times to escape and fails every time. And, of course, suffers extraordinary retribution as a result. All of this shows up. There's a story. Part one of Quixote has interpolated stories. Worth reading. They're good. One that comes near the end is called The Slave Story. A slave shows up at an inn, an escaped slave from northern Africa, tells about what it was like to be a slave. Well, we know how Cervantes knew about that. He was for 5 years. He turns it into this fictional story, the end of part one. Very interesting stuff. Fascinating stuff. He knew it well. Finally, the ransom is paid and he's released. He heads back to Spain and says, I fought at Lepanto, and the response is, didn't everybody? You too? Everybody, by that point, was claiming to have fought at Lepanto. Okay? It had become a popular way to advance yourself, to guarantee your interests, to get some rewards. Nobody was falling for it anymore, even for someone like Cervantes, who was actually there, who in fact lost a hand, lost use of his hand, didn't matter. He got nothing for it. This point, he's got to earn a living. He tries writing, failure after failure after failure. He writes some poetry, goes nowhere. He writes some plays, sort of successful, who cares, goes nowhere. He then is commissioned by Philip II of Spain to help organize supplies for the attack on England by the Spanish Armada. And he has a certain amount of grain. I think it's grain. I'll just say grain. It may have been wheat, some specific grain. He has to get together to put on the ships to send. He's in charge. He's one of the men in charge of this. He can't come up with the numbers. He takes from ecclesiastical orders, and he gets excommunicated. It only lasted about a year before he was back in good standing again. But he's trying to do the king's bidding. He's trying to do what he's supposed to do, and as a result, he gets excommunicated. And then he's thrown in prison for a while. And then, of course, we know what happens with the Spanish Armada when they attack England. One of the most painful moments. I still don't understand it. I just have to assume at some point it will be revealed. There had to be a reason for Spain's extraordinary defeat. I don't know. It's a mystery to me. That's another topic for another time. Following that, he is still kicking around, trying to support his family, trying to do something, and he becomes, this is a good profession, a tax revenue collector. Well, he's doing that briefly, and he's thrown in prison again because of discrepancies here and there or somebody. I don't know the details. He's back in prison for a while again. He gets out again. The point I'm making here, the man never succeeded at anything. Failure, 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 one after another. But what's very clear is he just kept going. It's got to be part of the inspiration for this book. Oh, failed again. Okay, onward. Not an easy thing to do, but it says something about the spirit of the man. And it obviously has to say something about his faith. Failed again, onward. No matter what he did, it was a bust. And then he starts writing another book. He writes a pastoral romance, La Galata. It goes nowhere. Okay. He starts writing this book. Part one is published in 1605. It is an enormous success. It is a huge hit. Except there are no copyright laws. Every printer who can get a copy is publishing it. He makes no money from it. He has a nationwide hit on his hand, but there are no bestseller lists, there are no copyright laws. He doesn't make any money. He's still broke. He's famous, but he's still trying to support his family. But everybody was reading Quixote. Wonderful story. King Philip II dies in 1598. Book published in 1605. Philip III is king of France. He's in one of his palaces. He goes to the window, looks down, and sees a young man lying on the ground, on the palace grounds, having convulsions. He says to his aide, run down there at once. There's a young man having convulsions. The aide comes back up and says to him, no, he's fine. He's reading Don Quixote. Philip says, oh, that's funny. Meaning the king knew how funny the book was. He's convulsed with laughter. He's reading Quixote. Oh, well, yes, of course. It's one of those wonderful moments when you realize that the high and mighty, the best of them, knew certain things about the great art. Tangent. One of my favorite stories about Pope St. Pius X. I love this story. I'm an opera fan, so I love this story. One of his assistants comes to him and says, we got a problem in northern Italy. A lot of the churches during Mass are using music from Bellini's operas. The Pope says, they're doing what? Well, they're taking the music from Bellini's operas and performing it during the Mass. Different words, but it's the music. In fact, a lot of them are setting Mira o Norma, the great duet for two sopranos, from Bellini's Norma. And the Pope says, no, this has got to stop. No. So, okay, well, we got to put an end to this right now. Inappropriate, shouldn't be done. See to it. I'll sign it. It's got to stop right now. Isn't that lovely? It's got to stop right now. The end of it. Enough. So, I'll sign it and get it done. Oh, man. Well, a man may dream. But it actually happened. So the guy says, well, right away, Your Holiness. He starts to leave the room, and the Pope stops and says, ah, but it is very beautiful music, and sings the Mira o Norma. He knew it by heart. Ah, but it is very beautiful music, but inappropriate for that occasion. Okay? Again, just sanity. Oh, dear. So Cervantes, not having made money from part one, decides to do what? What anyone who is really successful does, he starts writing part two. It's going to be a sequel. He's working on the sequel. He gets ready to publish part two of Don Quixote, and part two of Don Quixote comes out, written by another man. No copyright laws. Some bright fellow says, look at what a hit this book is. Well, I'll do a sequel. His name is Avellaneda, and he gets his sequel out first. It's terrible. It's El Stinko. And of course, all these people who love part one are running now and buying part two and going, man, this is terrible. What happened to Quixote? Well, this is just terrible. I will go into this in a later lecture. Cervantes counters this by including the phony sequel and references to it in his part two. It gets so weird I can't even describe it. But that's coming up later. Stick around. It's just, your heads will spin. It's on. Anyway, what it means is he brings out his sequel. Oh, it's another sequel. 1615, it comes out. The second part two. In a way, it doesn't matter. He falls ill shortly after part two is published. And on April 23rd, 1616, surrounded by his family and with the sacraments of the church, he dies and is buried in his plain habit from the Third Order of St. Francis. Not a bad death. And my goodness, what he left us. Now, there's one curiosity here. April 23rd, 1616. Somebody else died that day. Up in England, a man named William Shakespeare. The greatest English writer and the greatest Spanish writer died on the same day, April 23rd, 1616. Feast of St. George. Shakespeare, of course, was born on April 23rd. Feast Day of St. George, died on an April 23rd, Feast Day of St. George, both the patron saint of England, needless to say. But Cervantes died on April 23rd, the Feast Day of St. George, the greatest of knights. The greatest of knights. And there's a wonderful reference at the end of part two where Quixote talks about St. George. I'll read it to you later. It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. Look at, where does the time go? Well, fortunately, you're being forced to listen to me again later. I'll tell you what, I'll do this very quickly, and then I'll stop and take some questions, and I'll continue tonight. I taught many seminars over my years as a literature teacher. I was very lucky. Seminars on Shakespeare's plays, the tragedies, the romances. I twice got to teach seminars on Dante's Divine Comedy, the whole thing. Beginning of the semester, started at Canto 1 of the Inferno and ended at the end of the semester with the last canto of the Paradiso. Taught a seminar I loved on the Greek tragedies, had a wonderful time. But my favorite seminar I ever taught was, it dawned on me, a few years back, I taught this in 2004. I'm reminiscing, pardon. 1605, Quixote is published. 1605, King Lear is first performed. You had, in England, Shakespeare writing what may be the greatest tragedy ever written, and Cervantes writing the greatest comedy ever written, and they're both about two old men who go mad. So I did a seminar called Two Mad Old Men, Lear and Quixote. And we put the two books side by side, and the parallels are staggering. Just unbelievable. Lear with his fool by his side. Quixote with Sancho Panza by his side. The young man in Lear who pretends to be mad and is out in the countryside, Edgar. In Quixote, Cardenio. The young man who pretends to go mad and is out in the countryside. You start going through. It's as if there was some sort of telepathic communication between these two men. But I also believe there was a reason for it. And I'll leave it hanging there and pick up with that tonight, okay? That's called always leaving hanging. It's called the cliffhanger. It's 3:16. Boy, I'd only intended to go an hour. I went longer, but once the mouth starts going, I say once I die, they're going to have to stop my jaw with a stick. They'll just have to beat it. They'll just keep going. Quite happy to take questions about this or any other subject. I'm more than happy to take some questions if you have any. If you don't, you can go on to more interesting things. But if anybody's got a question, feel free. Shoot it this way. No question is too stupid. All questions are unanswerable. Yes. By the way, your good vice rector, I remember him when he was just a young man sitting back there the way you were. I knew him when. See, someday you may grow up and be a vice rector too. You never know. Yes, Father.
Here ends the first part of this conference. Please enter the next CD in order to hear its conclusion.